So one of the pleasures of teaching this course and having guest speakers is the pleasure to introduce some of my heroes when they come to visit NYU. And although it would be a great honor to introduce Professor Lessig tonight, someone deserves it more than me, and that's Fred Benenson. Fred started the Free Culture Club here at NYU, and now he works in community outreach for Creative Commons. So Fred's going to introduce Professor Lessig.
I started off in this world because I was really interested in technology, and I quickly saw how broken copyright was, but it wasn't until I read Lessig's work in maybe 2002 and 2003 that I realized that a lot of the issues implicated by copyright law and technology were much broader cultural issues. The ideas about control and culture and how we make new culture turned out to be really significant, and since then, just like probably a lot of you in this room, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be involved in this movement. I wouldn't have a job if it weren't for Lessig. Now he's flushing and trying to deny it. But he's a great friend, a mentor of mine, once upon a time my boss, and I think you should really enjoy what he has to say tonight. So no credentials, just no fancy talk without further ado. Larry Lessig.
Thanks, Fred. So I want to offer some stories, make an observation on our way to an argument about what we should do about the relationship between technology and the regulation of culture through something we call copyright. So here are the stories. There are four of them. The first is really short. Watch. A way long time ago, back when they did things like this, the elite spoke Latin. The vulgar spoke languages like these languages. Now, the elite ignored the masses, and the masses ignored the elite. That's the first story. It's very short. Here's the second story. 1906, this man, John Philip Sousa, traveled to this place, United States Capitol, to talk about this technology, what he referred to as the, quote, talking machines. John Philip Sousa was not a fan of the talking machines. This is what he had to say. These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, this is the picture I want you to focus on, this picture of young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. This is a picture of culture. Using modern computer terminology, we could call it a kind of read-write culture. It's a culture where people participate in the creation and the recreation of their culture. In that sense, it's read-write. And Sousa's fear was that we would lose the capacity to engage in this kind of read-write creativity because of these, quote, infernal machines. They would take it away, displace it. And in its place, we'd have the opposite of read-write creativity, what we could call, using modern computer terminology, a kind of read-only culture. Read only in the sense that creativity is consumed, but the consumer is not a creator. Culture in this sense that's top-down, where the vocal cords of the millions of ordinary citizens have been lost. That's two. Here's three. 1928, in this place, Seattle, there's a bunch of these guys, bootleggers. And they were making life really difficult for these guys, police, making difficult for them to do their job because in 1928, as you all know, we lived in an age of prohibition, alcohol, production and sale of alcohol prohibited. So those guys went around and did things like this, captured whiskey, arrested people who were producing it. And a new technology came along that would enable them to do their job much better, the wiretap. So this job, stopping illegal bootlegging, would be enabled because wiretapping would enable the police to fight back against the criminals. And here's some of the criminals. This is Roy Olmsted. And Roy and 11 other people were the target of a criminal prosecution that got to the Supreme Court under the name of Olmstead versus the United States. And the central question in Olmstead was whether it was legal for the government to wiretap Mr. Olmstead and his associates' telephones without a warrant. So the Supreme Court looked at this document, the Constitution of the United States, in particular, the Fourth Amendment to that Constitution. There's the Fourth Amendment. Actually, it looks a little bit more like that. and looked at this clause in particular, that we have a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And the question was, if the government taps your phone without any judicial authorization, is that an unreasonable search or seizure? Well, Chief Justice Taft examined the history of the Fourth Amendment and said the Fourth Amendment was about protecting against government trespasses on your property. The wiretap was not affected through a trespass. They didn't enter the house. They just attached some wires to the wires as they left the house. Therefore, no trespass. Therefore, no violation of the Fourth Amendment. Justice Brandeis wrote a very famous dissent, which he disagreed with this conclusion, said that there's a principle built into the Fourth Amendment. It is to protect against a certain kind of invasion and to protect against the invasion of privacy. And how you protect against that invasion, of course, is going to depend. It's going to be a function of technology. And time works changes in those technologies, meaning we need to translate the protections of one age into a different age. The old protections translated into a new context, which in this case would mean that the wiretap would be illegal. That was a dissent. It was 40 years before the court revisited the question and reversed that opinion. Okay, that's the third story. Here's the fourth, final story. 1933 is the date for this story, because the battle which Roy Olmstead was in the middle of course, was caused by a decision made in 1919 when the United States declared war on alcohol. It was a war, a moral war, an economic war. It was a war in which the dependence of the culture on alcohol was seen to be a threat to the safety and health of the nation. So this war was waged, as all wars are waged, without limit. And by 1933, the country was increasingly aware of the increasing costs of this war, costs that weren't actually contemplated at the time that the country, in this great act of progressive transformation, enacted into law this radical change in the behavior, at least of a significant section of our society. So costs like the rise of organized crime, not contemplated at the time that they enacted this change, and the fall of civil rights, as Olmstead versus the United States evinces. And they began to realize by 1933 that maybe these costs were greater than the benefits, or they began to realize that they could get the benefits of this war, or at least much of the benefits of this war, without much of the costs. So in 1933, the country ended prohibition. Peace was declared. The 21st Amendment repealed the 18th Amendment, but what's important here is what was repealed was not the fight against dependence on alcohol. That fight continued. What was repealed was the idea of using this kind of war, war enacted through law, prohibition, as the means to fight that dependence. Okay, there's the fourth story. This is not my music, I promise. Here's the observation. So think about this idea of writing. In a way, I want you to get, it'll be pretty obvious, you're pretty smart, you'll get it pretty quickly, but writing, I want you to recognize, is an extraordinarily democratic activity. By which I don't mean that we vote about what each of us writes. I mean writing is the sort of activity that everyone is to have the capacity to engage. Everybody's supposed to be able to write. And we teach people, obviously, how to write, and we measure education on the basis of whether people know how to write. Now, why do we do this? Why do we teach people how to write? I mean, I understand first to eighth grade, it's pretty important. You've got to be able to know how to get around in maps and things like that. But why ninth grade to college? Why do we teach people how to write by studying Shakespeare or Hemingway? Or why do we tell them to write an essay on Proust? Like, why would this make any sense? What's the gain from this? Because as you know, or you should know, or at least the people in here who teach know, the vast majority of this writing is just crap. Total crap. So why do we do it? Why do we force kids to go through this process of writing? Why do we, more importantly, force professors to read it? Well, I think the answer to this question at the core of this observation, the observation that I want you to focus on as we think about the rest of the issues in this context of copyright, is that we learn something, obviously, by this practice of learning how to write. We learn a certain respect for the creator by learning how to write, by practicing this thing of writing. We learn just how hard this kind of creativity is and the value of this form of expression. Now, in this practice of writing, there is something we take for granted called quoting. Those of us over the age of 40, by quoting in our heads, is fixed this idea of taking words from someone else and using it in some set of words that we are creating. A friend of mine in college wrote essays that were all of this form, right? Just quote, 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 quote. He got A pluses in every single class he took. He was brilliant. Brilliant in taking other people's words and using them to express ideas that once understood showed that he understood the material more than the people he was writing about. This was what creative writing was for him, to take and use and build upon other people's works. And here's the obvious point, without permission. I mean, so long as he cited. If he didn't cite, that's plagiarism, the only offense I think the death penalty is appropriate for. As long as he cites, he gets to use without permission. Indeed, imagine how absurd it would be if he asked, right? Ben called up the estate of Hemingway and said, do you mind if I quote these three sentences in my college essay about Hemingway? Right? Imagine how absurd it is. And when you imagine that, when you recognize the absurdity, you recognize the essentially democratic character of writing. We all have the right to write in exactly this way, to take and use freely without permission from anyone. Okay, that's the observation. Here's the argument. So I want you to think about what writing or creating in a digital age should be. What should this freedom to write, or the freedom to quote, or the freedom to remix in this digital age be? Because we should notice, I think you'll notice quickly, certain parallels between the stories I told you. Just happened to be that these parallels were there. No, actually, I constructed them to have these parallels. These parallels between the stories I told you and the character of that battle that's going on right now over the regulation of culture through something called copyright. So, as with the war against bootlegging, we are also in the middle of a war. In the United States, of course, we have a lot of wars, but the one I'm pointing to is the copyright wars. Wars which my friend, the late Jack Valenti, referred to as his own, quote, terrorist war, end quote, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. And as with the war that surrounded the battles that Sousa was launching, this war is a war inspired by certain changes in technology. Changes in technology which the artists and industry are now terrified about, terrified that this new technology will affect a radical change in how culture gets made. And as with the issue raised at the 21st Amendment, the abolishment of prohibition, these wars increasingly raise a fundamental question. Are the costs of this war greater than the benefits? Or alternatively, can we get the benefits of this war without the enormous costs that it imposes? Well, to answer that question, in my view, you've got to think a little bit about what the benefits of copyright are. So, copyright, as you recognize, I'm sure, is a certain solution to a particular kind of problem, a problem which creative work presents because it produces what economists call a positive externality, which, unless there's a way for the creator to internalize, doesn't create sufficient incentive for some to create. In my view, this is an essential solution to an unavoidable problem. It's in the nature of this expression that it has this problem attached to it. Without this system of copyright, which is a restriction on speech, paradoxically, we would have less speech. We limit the freedom to speak by, for example, copying other people's creative work to produce more free speech. In other words, the work that is now incentivized by the monopoly that copyright is. But as with privacy, the right regulation to affect this balance is a function of technology, and as technology changes, the architecture of the right regulation is going to change as well. What made sense in one period can make no sense in another period, and we need to adjust what makes sense to achieve the same value in these different contexts. So with copyright, what's the right regulation look like? Well, I think we need to distinguish, as Sousa did, between the amateur and the professional. And we need to recognize, as Sousa did, that a copyright system needs to encourage both kinds of creativity. We need to have incentives for the professional and freedom for the amateur. Now, to see how this is possible, I think we can see something of it in the evolution of how digital technologies have interacted with the creation of culture over the last decade. So I want to mark it out in three stages. The first stage, circa 2000, was the recognition increasingly imposed on the content industry that digital technologies were actually a way to extend the read-only culture that had defined the 20th century. Massively efficient technologies to enable people to get and consume culture created elsewhere. This is the poster child of this vision of culture. Apple with its iTunes music store enabling you to buy any song for 99 cents and download it to your iPod, but only to your iPod, but you're guaranteed at least to be cool if you engage in this form of cultural expression. This is the vision of the digital jukebox that my colleague Paul Goldstein spoke of more than 20 years ago, a vision of the capacity to capture and get access to any culture produced anywhere automatically for some fee. It's a critically important part of culture, valuable both culturally and economically, and will always be a part of how culture gets produced and shared. The second stage of culture, though, circa 2004, is substantially different from the first. What I think of as a kind of revival here of the read-write culture that Sousa was celebrating. This is the poster child for this picture of culture, Wikipedia. But the part I want to focus on here, I think of as a distinct subset of this, what we could call remix. Now, I'm sure many here are very familiar with this. Here are some examples to make sure we're all on the same page. You can think about remix in a professional context. So think about remix in the music context. 2004, this first instance was recognized. So we all know this album by the Beatles, the White Album, which inspired this album by Jay-Z called The Black Album, which inspired this album by DJ Danger Mouse called The Gray Album, which literally synthesizes the tracks of the White Album and Black Album together to produce something gray. Okay, so here's two works being synthesized together. The current equivalent of this is something like Girl Talk. There can be 280 different tracks being mixed together in one of the songs which Girl Talk will perform and obviously records. Or in the context of film, 2004, Tarnation made its debut at Cannes, said by the BBC to wow Cannes. This was a film made for $218. Kid took video that he had shot through his whole life, and using an iMac given to him by a friend, he could remix it in a way that could wow Cannes and win the 2004 Los Angeles International Film Festival. Or think about amateurs in their creation using these technologies of remix. Explosion of something called anime music videos out there. So everybody knows anime, these Japanese cartoons increasingly sweeping American culture. Anime music videos are made when the kids take, or adults take, these anime and re-edit them and set them to a different music track. So here's a trivial example of this. Or it can be something a little bit more clever like this. Or think about YouTube, which has become an extraordinarily important platform for this form of expression, and developing something you think of as a kind of call and response in the context of these digital creations. So here's an example. This video is posted on YouTube. When I saw it, there's about 1.7 million views of this video. I do videos on YouTube, so I'm always trying to figure out how to get more viewership. So I've never gotten close to 1.7 million, but I've never danced in my videos, so maybe next time. Then that inspired this video. This, of course, got about 3.2 million views. And there are an extraordinary number of other call and responses from this as well. Or here's another example. That inspired this. And then that inspired this. The thing to recognize is that these are increasingly conversations that are breaking out on this platform. People from all across the world creating and responding in this expressive form. It's the modern equivalent to what Sousa spoke of when he spoke of the young people getting together, singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Or maybe most important ultimately would be in the context of politics. This is a British thing sweeping Britain right now. Of course, everybody's seen this natural expression of political speech in this age. It's not clear this would have been understandable a decade ago. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists, and it laid the trail toward freedom. But this is still my very favorite.
There's only you in my life. The only thing that's right.
Okay, so that's remix in a digital age. And the important thing here, the importance of this remix, of course, has nothing to do with the particular technique. Because, of course, these techniques have been available to anybody with video or film for the last 50 years. The importance here is that this technique has been democratized. It's the fact that anybody with access to a $1,500 computer can take sounds and images from the culture around us and remix them to say things differently, to say things in a way that's much more powerful than words could ever be, at least to a generation that increasingly tunes out to the Latin that words represent, and increasingly tunes into the expression in the vulgar that is media for this culture. Now, the key here, then, is to recognize how increasingly this is just writing. This is writing in a new era, right? It is the equivalent, of course, of the contrast, perhaps, between the world where Latin is the elite's language, and in our culture, text is the Latin, and media is the vulgar language, where remix increasingly expresses itself through this media. It is writing for the 21st century, images, sounds, and videos taking the place of words for an extraordinarily important component of our culture. Now, in this space where this is writing, what is quoting? What is quoting? What is the literacy of this writing depend upon for quoting? Well, quoting here must include the capacity to include sounds and images from the culture around you as you produce this form of expression. But the norms and laws surrounding this kind of quoting, taking music, taking images, taking video, and including it in your own expression, require permission first. The law requires, according to those who enforce these rules, permission first. Why is that? Well, it's because of a technical feature of the architecture of copyright law and a technical feature of the architecture of digital technologies. So if copyright law is at its core triggered by the production of something called a, quote, copy, the one thing we know about digital technologies is that every single time you use creative work in the context of digital technology, you produce a copy, which means every time you use it, you trigger the application of copyright law. Now, it's first important to recognize this is a radical change over any period in the history of free society. Right? So think about the old days when you did things like reading books. Today we just buy them, which is good for me, but you know, read books, like physically read a book, right? If you think about a physical book, think about these as all the possible uses of a physical book. First thing to recognize is a whole bunch of these uses are technically unregulated by the law. So to read a book is not a fair use of the book. It's a free use of the book, because to read a book is not to produce a copy. To give someone a book is not a fair use of a book, it's a free use of a book. Because to give someone a book is not to produce a copy. To sell a book is explicitly exempted from the regulation of copyright law in the United States, because to sell a book is not to give somebody a copy. To sleep on a book is a totally unregulated act in every jurisdiction around the world. To sleep on a book is not to produce a copy. Then at the core of these potential uses of this book are a set of uses that are properly regulated by copyright law. To create the incentive, the law says, must be created to inspire people to produce great new works. So to publish a book requires the permission of a copyright owner, because without that exclusive right for at least some creators of some books, there would be insufficient incentive to produce that book. And then there's a thin sliver of exceptions, which American law has developed, called fair uses. Uses which otherwise would have been regulated by the law because they involve producing a copy, but which the law says ought to remain free so as to assure that culture can build upon earlier work or critique earlier work. Okay. Unregulated, regulated, and fair uses. Three categories. Enter the net, where every single use produces a copy. It means we go from this balance of unregulated, regulated, and fair uses to a radically different balance merely because the platform through which we get access to our culture has changed. And what this means is activities like read-write culture using digital technologies are presumptively illegal. So DJ Danger Mouse knew he could never get permission to remix the Beatles' works. This kid discovered after he discovered he could wow Khan for $218 that it would cost over $400,000 to clear the rights to the music in the background of the video that he shot. Increasingly, kids producing AMVs are finding letters, nasty letters, from lawyers telling them to remove the copyrighted material they have remixed from their website. And this, again, is still my very favorite example. I don't care what you think about Tony Blair. I don't care what you think about George Bush. I don't care what you think about the war. But I have a clue. But I don't care what you think about any of those people. The one thing I don't think you can say is what the lawyer said when they were asked for permission to synchronize those images with that music. The lawyer said, no, you cannot have our permission to synchronize those images with this extraordinary song because, quote, it's not funny. So the point is, we need to recognize that no one in this place ever thought about this fact, right? There was never an ATM RICA Act, the Act to Massively Regulate Every Creative Act Act. This is simply the unintended consequence of the interaction between these two architectures of regulation, one to regulate culture called copyright, the other to regulate access to culture through digital technologies. This, I think of, is problem number one that we face in this context. The law basically out of sync with the technology, and just as with the Fourth Amendment, we need to update that law. So just as the Fourth Amendment needed to be updated to take care of wiretapping, so too copyright law needs to be updated to take care of the internet. That's problem one. Problem two is the recording industry's problem number one, piracy, or peer-to-peer, quote, piracy. The, quote, terrorism where the kids are the terrorists. This problem is what's produced the, quote, war, a war which I want you to see as a war of prohibition, a war of prohibition on the way people act in their ordinary lives. And the critical thing to recognize about this war is that it has not worked. If worked means reduce the, quote, bad behavior, this war has been a failure. Because the one thing we know, for example, about peer-to-peer file sharers, as this graph clearly shows, is that they don't read Supreme Court opinions, because this is where the Supreme Court unambiguously declared that this activity of peer-to-peer file sharing presumptively violates copyright law. Yet, there's no drop-off. We have more peer-to-peer file sharing today than we did a decade ago, and there's nothing to indicate that that trend is going to change. All that this war has done, and it's done this very well, is to raise a generation contemplating the fact that it is a criminal generation. Now, it's this activity, the act of criminal behavior, or the act that a generation is thought of as criminal, that creates lots of sadness out there. There's a little representation of it. But what I want you to do is to begin to see some of the happiness that might come if we could only get over some of these problems. There's the happiness of it, right? And the happiness begins by thinking about what I think of as the third stage of this development, something that I want to mark circa 2008. The development of what we could call the hybrid. Okay, so to understand the hybrid, we've got to think first about a weird way I want to use the word economies. So by economies, I only mean to refer to practices of exchange. So they're practices of exchange over time. It's not like a one-shot relationship. It's something that goes on for a period of time. And I want you to see then there are three kinds of economies that we can observe in this space. The most obvious economy are economies tied to money, what I'll call commercial economies. Economies where you walk into, for example, a grocery store, and you recognize the relationship you have to the grocery store is the quid pro quo relationship of this for that, where the this for that is articulated in terms of money. This is Yochai Benckler's understanding of what the commercial economy is about. Relationships defined with this term as the measure between the this and the that. And in this type of economy, money is a completely appropriate way to speak, right? So you go into this economy and they talk about sale as a way to induce more buying or a price increase to unfortunately produce less buying. All of this is about money being used and money being the term of expression. It's how we speak. It's totally appropriate in a commercial economy. But as Yochai nicely distinguishes, some economies here have nothing to do with money. These I want to call sharing economies. So, for example, this is a sharing economy. This is a sharing economy. This is a sharing economy. These are economies in the sense that they're ongoing relationships. It's not like one shot and it's got to work over time, or it should work over time. They're sharing in the sense that the giving and taking has nothing to do with money. For these economies, money is not how we speak. Indeed, if we introduced money into these economies, we would radically change the nature of the conversation. So if in an economy like this, one person said, well, how about let's get together next week, and the other person said, nah, I'll give you $50 instead. It's not just weird, it's not just unusual, it radically changes what the economy is. Or imagine dropping $50 or $150 or $500 into the middle of this relationship, right? It no longer is this relationship, it's that relationship. So the point is, in these sharing economies, it's not just that money is unusual. Money is a social meaning that is inappropriate in these spaces. Now, even the most right-wing conservative, I think, recognizes that these economies are rich and important parts of human life. Indeed, many right-wing conservatives fight vigorously to keep money out of some of these economies. For example, the sex economy. To keep money out is what it is to be a conservative. That's the prohibition of against prostitution, right? But that recognition is also goes along with the recognition these economies coexist. Commercial economies coexist with sharing economies. Now, in the internet space, we obviously have clear examples of both of these two types. So there's commercial economies and sharing economies. Sharing economies like Wikipedia or OpSound or SETI at Home, people engaging in practices that are producing good for each other, but never is money how these practices mediate their behavior. So it's not just that Wikipedia doesn't pay people to edit. If it started paying people to edit, I believe the quality of editing would decline. Some of you might not think it's high anyway, but anyway, if you do, like I believe it's very important and valuable, the quality would go down because people would think of their relationship differently. Same thing in the commercial economy. Obviously, many important places out there on the web that are defined primarily in terms of this commercial quid pro quo. But the thing to recognize is that the most interesting stuff going on in the net is actually a hybrid between these two. This is actually a commercial entity that's leveraging a sharing economy, or increasingly sharing entities that are leveraging commercial economies. So, for example, think about Flickr. Born as a photo sharing site, sharing was at the core of what it spoke about. It created communities that were around the idea of sharing knowledge and images, knowledge about how to make great photos, images for people to use however they want, and giving you the power to explicitly mark your images with licensing that enabled that sharing perfectly legally. That was a sharing economy where sharing is at the core. But obviously, the aim of Yahoo in buying Flickr was not just to give away more of its corporate value. It's done that a lot, but not just that. It was because Yahoo expected it would be able to leverage value out of this sharing economy by building on the activity of sharing in a way that profited Yahoo. Google has followed the same thing with Picasa just this last year, and the coolest new photo sharing site out there, Photonauts, has at its core this express embrace of the power to share. Or think about Yelp, exactly the same dynamic. We're increasingly spend an enormous amount of their time going out there and marking and writing up reviews about sites that build communities around locations in physical space for the purpose of sharing their views, but obviously producing great value to the owner of Yelp, or that's their hope. We're thinking about something like Second Life, a site which began as this virtual world where what the world looked like originally was these vast spaces of green or ocean, but where people have gone and voluntarily, indeed paid for the right to build an enormous amount of stuff in this space, buildings or objects or environments that attract other people in. Now, they do this primarily as a sharing activity, but obviously Linden Labs, the owner of this site, expects to leverage this in a way that produces money. Now, in a case, all of these are hybrid economies, all of these examples. And my first point is to get you to see that once you see these as hybrids, you begin to see the hybrids everywhere. So is Amazon really just a commercial site? Right? Because much of the value that's produced inside of Amazon is produced by the enormous amount of effort that people devote to making it easier for other customers to understand where they ought to be going and what they ought to be buying. Apple is increasingly developing the same thing. Even Microsoft, for many years, has recognized they had an enormous potential to increase the profit of their bottom line by enlisting for free their customers in the activity of helping other people navigate the difficulty of Microsoft products. So you go to Microsoft's Product Support Center. It's basically a Usenet group where people spend thousands of hours devoted to making sure Bill Gates' company makes more money. And indeed, it's not an accident. This guy is a genius. This guy, Mark Smith, inside of something called the Communities Technologies Group, spends his whole time developing these technologies to measure the health, quote, health of the, quote, communities that Microsoft is, quote, fostering in this space, so that people increasingly feel devoted not to going out and helping their church or helping their local soup kitchen, but helping Microsoft by making Microsoft's products better for other people. Now, when you see this, you begin to see why somebody like Steve Ballmer, at a talk I saw him give a year and a half ago, said every successful internet business will become what I've called here a hybrid. Okay, there's an argument. Here's something about what I think we need to do here. First, we need to think about reforms in the way the law tries to regulate culture. And the first reform, kind of a geeky sort of lawyer-focused reform, but I apologize, I can't help it sometimes, is to for the law to give up its obsession with the copy. You have the system of regulation which is triggered every time a copy is made. Right? The point to recognize is that this system is insane in the current context. It's a technical legal term, but it's accurate here. We need to focus the law on meaningful activities, meaningful to the underlying purpose of copyright, and copying is not the meaningful activity anymore. So what is meaningful? Well, meaningful is going to depend upon the context of use. So think about the distinction between copying and remixing. So copying, just taking the whole of an album and distributing it to your 50,000 best friends, or remixing it, taking it and doing something with it. And distinguish between the amateur and the professional, somebody who's in the act of creating because of the money, somebody who's in the act of creating because of the love of the creativity. That produces a matrix, I apologize, but here it is. Copyright now presumptively regulates all of it. That is what I think is technically insane. Never before in the history of copyright law has it purported to reach this broadly, and it certainly makes no sense now for the law to reach this broadly. Certainly, copyright law has an important and necessary objective in regulating efficiently here. Professionals producing creative work need to at least be protected in the for the distribution of the copies of that work. But the first important change here. It is recognized that even if this should continue to be solidly regulated by copyright law, this should not. This area, amateurs remixing culture, should not be fair use under copyright law. It should be an absolutely free use, presumptively outside of the reach of copyright law, so 15-year-olds don't need lawyers sitting next to them as they produce things on their computer. Now, these other two boxes are a little bit more complicated. There needs to be a mix. This is where fair use has its real role, a mix between places where the law needs to continue to control and where the use needs to be set free. But the critical thing that I hope, at least if there's some people here who are conservative or at least talk to conservatives, the critical thing to recognize is that what this is an argument in favor of deregulating culture, right? Deregulating a significant space of culture and focusing this regulation in places where it plausibly could do some good. Okay, that's the first change. Here's the second. With respect to peer-to-peer, quote, piracy. So the thing to recognize is we're a decade into this war, a war which I've said is a total failure. Now, the response of some people, seems to be an American response, to totally failed wars is to wage an ever more effective war against the enemy until finally we wake up. That's the objective that was Jack Valenti's objective in recognizing this war. But the response of some to these wars is exactly the opposite to this, which is to find a way to sue for peace. Now, for the last decade, there's been a slew of proposals by the most creative legal academics around the country for ways to sue for peace here, meaning finding ways to compensate artists without attempting to control the copy of their work. Some of these are proposals for compulsory licenses. The EFF has a voluntary collective license. Whatever the particular solution is, the thing we should recognize a decade into this war is if we had had these proposals in effect a decade ago, how would the world be different today? First and most important, perhaps to some, is artists would have more money. Because the one thing artists have not gotten from this war on peer-to-peer file sharing is any money. Indeed, when the RIAA sues, for downloads, the artists don't get any money from that. It's the RIAA and the lawyers who get money for that. So one, artists would have had more money. Two, if the rules had been clear, we would have had an explosion of other businesses beyond Apple trying to be innovative in ways that they can exploit and take advantage of these new technologies for producing and sharing content. If the rules had been clear, more innovation in business. But the one that's most important to me, the thing that inspired me to write this book, is not really concern about the artists, although I like artists as much as the next guy, and not so much concern about competition because I'm never getting any of that money. The thing that concerned me the most is this, that if we had had this a decade ago, we would not have a generation raised for the last 10 years recognizing that its most basic activities as they relate to the internet are criminal. Now, we need to consider these changes, I think. We needed to consider them a decade ago, but we need to consider them now. So let me give one more story to end this up. So I had the great chance to visit this place. You might recognize it because you're from New York. This is the Association of the Bar of the City of New York. And I was at this event. It was in this room. See this beautiful red velvet carpet, curtains and carpet throughout the room. The room was packed with a whole bunch of artists and creators and some lawyers who had come to understand, eager to understand, how they could create consistent with the American law of fair use. So American law of fair use has four separate factors. The lawyers that organized this event thought very logically about it. They said, okay, we'll ask four lawyers to spend 15 minutes each on each of those four factors, and 60 minutes later, the world will understand fair use. But as I sat there and I watched the audience, the reaction of the audience was more like this, which led me into a daydreaming state, right? So I was wondering, there's something about this room that was reminiscent. It was a kind of a deja vu experience. And I was thrown back to something I'd done when I was in my early 20s, which is spend a lot of time traveling. Oh, there's a mouse. Mickey, you've come. Free the mouse. Oh, that's so sad. About when I was in my 20s, I spent a lot of time traveling throughout the Soviet Union, and I began to think that this room was reminding me of that room, right? And then I began to think, when was it in the history of the Soviet system when you could have convinced the Soviets, the member of the Politburo, that the system had failed? 76 was probably too early. It was puttering along okay by then. 1889 was too late. If you didn't get it by 89, you just were never going to get it. So when was it, between 76 and 89, that you could have convinced them that this system had failed? And what could you have said to them, those Soviets, those members of the Politburo, to convince them that this idea that they had raised their whole life around, this romantic idea, had crashed and burned, and to continue with the Soviet system in the face of this reality was, in a certain sense, insane. Because as I listen to mainly lawyers, think of as us, or maybe us in the United States, insist, nothing has changed. The same rules should apply. It's the pirates that are the deviants. Well, maybe that's true, but I begin to recognize that it is we who are insane. The existing system here of copyright could never work in the context of digital technologies. Either we will force our kids to stop creating, or we will force a revolution on the system of copyright. Now, in my view, both of those options are not acceptable. I actually believe copyright is an essential part of the creative process, but we need to recognize that there is a growing movement of abolitionism out there, a movement that thinks copyright is totally unnecessary in the 21st century, we just need to wipe it from the books. Now, in this sense, I'm actually closer to Gorbachev than to Yeltsin, right? I'm just an old communist trying to keep the system going in a radically new context. That's what I want, is to ways to reform copyright, to keep it alive, to preserve copyright against these two extremes, both extremes which I think would destroy the system. Now, you might not be so motivated. You might say, I don't give a damn about the system of copyright, I don't give a damn about lawyers, it's not important to me. That's not my fear. And if you're so motivated, then let me just end with one more thought here. I think we need to come to this recognition. There's no way that we are going to kill this form of creativity. All we can do is criminalize it. There's no way we're going to stop our kids from creating using these technologies. All we can do is drive their creativity underground. We're not going to make our kids passive in the way that I was, at least growing up. All we can do is to make them, quote, pirates. And the question we need to ask is this any good in a free society? Our kids live in this age of prohibitions. In all sorts of dimensions of their life, they live life against the law. And we need to recognize how corrosive, how corrupting this is to the very idea of the rule of law. In a democracy, we should be able to do more than this, if this is indeed a democracy. Thank you very much.
I have to run in a bit, but we have time for a couple quick questions. So whoever gets their hand up first, back there.
Do you have any plans to move the block?
Do I have plans to move to Washington? I certainly hope not. No. Some of my best friends are moving to Washington, though, so, but no.
Over there, on the right.
So how do we push back? I mean, none of us are big multimedia conglomerates making tons of profit off of monopoly profits, so we're doing it.
Right, so I think the way to push back is to do things that change the debate. The way the debate's framed right now, the ordinary sort of Kansas view is that there are two sides. One side that's trying to protect the property system, and the other side that's just trying to steal things. That's the frame of the debate. And the reality is, in America, if that's the frame of the debate, we lose. Because no, America's not going to embrace the right to steal things. What we need to do is to get people to recognize that's not the only trade-off in this debate. that this is a debate that's much more fundamental, really about the right of kids to create, not the right to steal. I, you know, my book Free Culture, I think it's 17 times in the book, says I don't support the idea of people peer-to-peer file sharing contrary to the rights of the copyright owner. So I'm not supporting that. But I think we need to get people to recognize how there's more in this debate than just black and white about whether you support Hollywood or not. And we need to push recognition in all the places where it's most important. So the free culture movement, the Students for Free Culture, I think is the most important change in the last 10 years in this space, because this is a potential for you to begin to do things that wake people up to the fact it's not a black and white issue. Now, what you shouldn't be doing, I think, is going out and, quote, stealing things, like saying, oh, we're civil disobedience, we're going to download 50,000 songs, right? When my parents' generation were civil disobedience, they went to jail for that, right? This was serious, and they didn't benefit from their civil disobedience. They did stuff that was hurtful to them, right? They were trying to change the system. Downloading 50,000 songs is not hurting anybody except the artists, right? So that's not the way to change this view. What is the way to change this view is to start doing activist things that make people think about this. Like, for example, why do professors at a place like NYU publish articles in journals that restrict distribution of those articles to those who can pay the $50,000 that it costs to subscribe to those journals? Why do they do that? Right? There are plenty of exploding, you know, opportunities. I was on the board of Public Library of Science, I think one of the most important opportunities for people to publish in an open access way that guarantees that the knowledge you're producing is actually accessible to developing nations or people, you know, information about how to deal with malaria is actually accessible in places where there is malaria, right? So there's no good reason, in my view, to continue to support this old way of spreading knowledge. And this is the perfect place for, you know, activists to begin to say to professors, you know, what is it? What's going on here? Why don't you join with, for example, Harvard, and I think Stanford's going to do the same thing within the next 6 months, in requiring that every single piece of academic scholarship be accessible, at least in a non-commercial Creative Commons way, to anybody around the world. Right? That's something you can do. And when people hear this, they realize the activism isn't about, you know, you steal it. It's about, you know, it's about changing the system to make it make sense in the digital world.
Do you think there's a danger of the commercial versus non-commercial or amateur modes of production being irrelevant in the near future? And I'm thinking your way of talking about hybrid business models is one way to approach that. Another way is the notion of the promotional value of non-rivalrous goods being used to sell other rivalrous goods. Do you think it will become increasingly difficult to draw those lines, or do you think there's a difficult gray area and meaningful lines on either side of it, or how do you think about that?
I think that's difficult. I think that there's a more difficult problem, though, that the hybrids have to face. I think that, you know, there are kind of three hybrids out there, three kinds of hybrids. One hybrid is the Darth Vader hybrid. And I unfairly create that name in reference to class of hybrids and the Star Wars mashup site as an example, where they invite people to come and to do these remixes. You have all the Star Wars video there. You can remix. You can upload your remixes. You can upload songs to be remixed with the stuff, the images. But if you read the terms of service, all the rights to the remix are owned by George Lucas. Right? Indeed, even the song that you yourself has created, if you upload it to that site, Lucas has a perpetual worldwide royalty-free right to exploit that however he wants. Right? So this is sharecropping in the digital age. That's that kind of hybrid. And that kind of hybrid, I think, increasingly will get pushed out as people, as creators, begin to recognize, hey, you know, what are my rights here? And then that's the appropriate thing for them to think. Just like the copyright system wants you to think about copyrights, it's the right of the author. That's important. A second kind is kind of Google or YouTube, which is kind of the ostrich perspective. They don't really think about the creator here. They're just exploiting the value. They're not against him. They're not extracting, but they're, you know, kind of oblivious to it. The third kind is like is like Flickr or Second Life, where they explicitly authorize, explicitly say, you, the creator, are the owner of these rights, and you can do with them as you want, and we give you that freedom. Right? Now, the difference here suggests that there's an increasing debate about what a just hybrid looks like. And there are many who are increasingly saying, Om Malik, it's a great example, is saying, you know, these guys are going to make all sorts of money off our collective backs. Are we going to join in? Are we going to get anything from that? Not likely. And that recognition, I think, is the most difficult problem for the hybrid to recognize. How do you do it in a way that continues to get the enormous energy of people, creative energy of people, without them at some point saying, hey, to hell with this. I'm not going to help you make hundreds of billions of dollars when I don't get anything from it. I think that's going to be the hardest.
We got time for maybe one more.
Yeah, first of all, I love the way the argument's been advancing over time. I gotta wonder about the analytic distinction at this moment in history between the amateur and the professional. I think you could say, take Benkler's work and say that in the society he's imagining, when all acts have been commodified and turned into transactions in some ways, and as we can see in journalism, like, it's an odd time to try to, you know, enforce that boundary or that line. So what are you thinking in terms of, like, distinguishing amongst creators between the professionals and the amateurs in that case?
Well, I don't want to enforce a line, but I do think there is a difference between people who go out and create for the love of what they're doing, Benkler's idea of the amateur here, and people who are creating because they're trying to make money from it. I'm not saying one is better than the other. Obviously, you know, it's a fantastic thing that people can go out and make money from singing using copyright. Right? That's a fantastic thing. There are more people, more musicians making money today than there were from performing and from singing than there were in 1995. So that's a good thing. I'm not saying anything against the professional, but there are also people who are doing it for amateur reasons. Now, that's not to deny that there are people increasingly in the middle. Like, what are they really doing it for? So, like, imagine blogs that begin to doing advertising to their space and then begin to notice that they're making some money from that, so they begin to reframe how they're blogging to track that kind of advertising. There's lots of complexity about that, but just because there's complexity in the middle doesn't mean we shouldn't really try to understand the fundamental difference between the two paradigms at the extremes, because the law imagines that the only relevant creator here is this professional, and it doesn't care that its regulation has the effect of wiping out the ecology of the amateur. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
I mean, intentionality shows up in the law of first-degree murder, but, I mean, are you imagining, like, you know, a licensed class of creators that then are the professionals?
I'm imagining the reach of copyright law being triggered on something more subtle than the mechanical question of whether there's a copy. So, you know, I want a very clear line, for example, to exempt the amateur remix. You know, this is an issue which, when I first started talking to the United States, people were like, oh, is this really an important issue? But I just came back from Hong Kong, which has been increasingly regulated by American insistence that they adopt a set of rules that the Americans think are very important, rules that are more restrictive than are imposed in the American context. And I was at a talk where this kid told me about his friend who had posted a video where he had remixed a video and put some music to it and was arrested by the police and criminally prosecuted for copyright violations, right? Because they wanted to make an example to the whole community, right? So here's an activity which ought, if anything, ought to be totally free, unregulated, which is a criminal act because of the system that we impose or insist upon the Hong Kong people taking. And it's not just, you know, technically in Hong Kong, even here, right? So I begin this book with a story of a woman who captured this image of her 13-month-old dancing. So Stephanie Lentz sees her kid dancing, grabs her video camera, captures it. It's really cute. She wants to upload it to YouTube so her mother can see it. Uploads it to YouTube. Prince's lawyers discover it. In the background, on the radio or the CD player, Prince's music is playing. They begin the legal actions to get her to take this thing down from YouTube because, God forbid, Prince's music should be accessible without Prince's authorization of it. Right now, the law as it exists right now says that what she has done, according to Universal Music at least, is violation of copyright law. But if YouTube takes it down, YouTube has done nothing wrong. In my view, that's exactly backwards. Right? she should be completely exempt for what she's done. She should not be subject to the regulation of copyright law at all. If YouTube starts displaying this in a way that they're making money off of it, I have no problem with saying that YouTube's got to pay some collective license for the music that's played on YouTube. Why not? If a community playhouse has to pay for some licensing fee for people singing songs in the middle of a play. But the problem is that we just don't focus on why protecting and encouraging the amateur is a core part of what copyright needs to do. And we should focus on that, even if I agree with you, there are lots of people who are going to be right smack in the middle.
All right, that's it.